So that kind of gives, gives an overview. And by the way, Ian, they do Machu Picchu. They do, you know, just hiking around the Galapagos. I mean, it isn't just high altitude mountaineering stuff. How I kind of got into this, as I said, I got into mountaineering when I was in the military. I was a light infantry officer, and then was very active in my son's scout troop, and my son and I just did a lot of backpacking together when I was in back in Maryland. And I was looking for a sport that I could do with my son. I do a lot of marathon running. My son's not a runner, but he's a climber. And I wanted also to do something completely different than just running, because I just felt like I needed something completely different that would be more of a challenge in a completely different way. Again, you know, kind of going through the very, very painful, lengthy divorce process. As a case in point, in Maryland, unlike Indiana, the minimum time to get a divorce is 15 months. It took 2 years. My wife just retired from a bank executive position. And so, you know, after 25 years of unwinding, you know, a lot of different things, it was very, very complicated. And so I was looking for something also where I could get completely off the grid, and mountaineering kind of offers that. You know, when I just got back from Aconcagua, I was literally off the grid for 3 week period of time. And so, you know, nobody can reach you, and it's really, really liberating. So, you know, kind of getting back to, you know, some of life's lessons, a big part of it is just this need to really double down on this thing, mind, body, and spirit. I felt like I was already aligned to that. Again, I was a marathon runner, but I was really, I got into more aspects of that and took a deeper dive, because I was at a point where I knew that if I didn't do something completely radically different, I knew I was probably gonna head down a really deep rabbit hole. And so this was kind of an opportunity to kind of, you know, come to reckoning. I felt like I was kind of like going down a rabbit hole, and, you know, this is, you know, I think Jesus kind of grabbed me by the ankles and kind of pulled me up and headed me in a different direction. So the idea around the mind, body, spirit piece kind of aligns to this idea. Jesus, when he made the statement, just read this here. It's, I have told you all this so that you may have peace in me. Here on earth you will have many trials and sorrows, but take heart, because I have overcome the world. So this idea that we will have trials and challenges, it's not like Jesus said, well, you may have, you know, challenges on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but not the other days of the week. No, you will have challenges. And so it's this whole idea about anticipating that we're gonna have some tough times, and what is it that we can be doing now to kind of build that resilience to be able to do that. And so my focus has really been around this whole idea about mind, body, spirit. The mind piece, you know, just being really deliberate about learning new things, trying to, you know, being deliberate about traveling to new places. I'm starting to teach now, so that this is kind of forcing me now into a space that I'd never been in before. The body piece, over the past 10 years, I became a pescatarian, so I cut all meat out, and I was just eating fish, and then about 3 years ago, I became a vegan. I've cut out all processed food and all sugar out of my diet, and also alcohol. I gave up alcohol in Lent 2020. It's been actually 2018. I gave it started a group, signed a kind of a pact with a veterans group I call Team Joshua. These are veterans in the Veteran Treatment Court, and so I've kind of made agreement with them that if they stay alcohol free, I'm gonna do the same thing. I did that since 2018, and it turned out to be one of the biggest, I mean, it's just a huge gift from that standpoint. The other piece about the sleep piece, I'm pretty deliberate around that. And then spirit, I've got a spiritual coach, who is a monk at St. Meinrad's Arch Abbey. And I'm pretty deliberate around daily prayer time and devoting at least an hour, hour and a half every day to prayer, and then usually on Sundays, and then 1 week a month I do a spiritual retreat. I go out to a place in Big Sur, California. It's actually a 1 week of silence at a hermitage there. You don't have to be Roman Catholic to do these kind of things, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that next time. And then the last piece of that is practicing something called divine will, and it kind of blends into kind of the next chapter that I've been facing over the past year. I turned 65 last year, and I had a new VP of HR at IU, and my first meeting with him in June of last year, as I said to him, I was going to be leaving my HR career that I've been in since 1985 to do something else. I've had a job since I was 9 years old, delivering papers here for Bloomington Telephone, Herald Telephone. And I love work, and I want to continue to work until at least age 70. But I don't know what it is that I wanted to do. And so I told him that, that I just want to leave in May 31st of this year, not having any idea what I wanted to do. So it's been an exercise of kind of surrendering to something called divine will, which is where you just, you don't put in your will, but you just completely surrender to God on this. And that's what I do. I ask Jesus every morning for the past year to say, just open the doors you want me to walk through. I'm not going to apply to anything. I'm going to wait for you to come to me and tell me what you're, where you want me to go with my life. And I'll tell you what, it's at first it was a little frightening, but at the same time, it was very, very liberating, you know, to completely surrender to divine will. And so I've been pretty deliberate about that piece. Well, it turns out, I gave notice in June of last year. In August of last year, I started teaching part-time at Kelly, and I just found out a couple weeks ago that I'm going to be teaching full-time at IU starting in the fall. And again, I didn't apply for it. I just allowed Jesus to come into my life and just guide me to where I was supposed to be going. So that's kind of the next chapter of what's going on with that, and kind of learning something completely different from that standpoint. But I think the alignment about mind, body, spirit, anticipating that we're all going to have tough challenges, whatever it is, they come out of left field, and you know, it is what it is. So next time we'll wrap up. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what we're going to be doing at the end of the month, but what I encourage you to do, first of all, to open up to any kind of questions you might have, but also to kind of work on the questions that we have on the handout in your small groups with the questions. So why don't we take, say, 15 minutes?
Yeah, we want to give a little bit more just about kind of one of the clients, just kind of maybe just a little what it was like and just kind of some badass.
Yeah, the most recent one was Aconcagua. That was, it's down in... it's not an Argentina around the Chilean border. I go with Ian Taylor. I've climbed with him a number of times. He's become a personal friend of mine. This Aconcagua, it was a little bit more of a challenge because of the length of time, 3 weeks. But it was, it all depends on that, on the group of people you go with, like anything else. It could be a really bad experience or it could be a really, really good experience. I've had really, really good luck with some really, really good people. I mean, made this, you know, some of the people you see on that video are people that I've just become really, really close friends with over the last few years. In fact, we're, you know, planning other climbs coming up next year. But with Aconcagua, basically what you do, first of all, it takes like 30 hours to get there. There's no easy way. This is 3 to 7 airlines. And then what you do is you do a gear check and then you head out. In Aconcagua, you spend 5 days hiking through this valley. It's like a high desert valley. You sleep in tents. There are no showers or any of that kind of stuff. And then you get to what they call a base camp. And it's like a city that's set up only for 3 weeks. And they do have showers there and hot meals, but you still live in a tent. And then what happens is there are 3 high camps set up. And so what you do is you do a series of these leapfrog moves where you go from base camp to you spend a day carrying gear. It's called a carry day. You carry as much gear as you can up to the first camp, and then you come back and sleep that night. And then the next day, you have a move day where you move all the rest of your gear up to camp one. And then you do the same thing for camp two. You have a carry day where you carry as much stuff as you can up to camp two. Then you come down and sleep at camp one. And then the next day, you do the same thing. The last camp was, that altitude was higher than the summit of Kilimanjaro. And so it's camp three, it was over 20,000 feet. The thing about being at that altitude is that the longer you stay there, the more fatigued you get. So what happens is that you wait at camp two, which is lower elevation, to wait for your weather window to open up. And you may wait there 2 or 3 days, but when you got a good weather window baked in, that's when you make your move up to camp three. And what happened with us this time is the weather window opened up and we didn't have the time to do either a rest day or a partial carry day. We had to move all of our stuff on one day, which was a pretty tough day. We slept for about 12 hours and then we made the push to the summit. And you start climbing a little bit after midnight. It's mountaineering is a nice sport because you have to get off the mountain by about noon, because what happens is the mountain starts to get heated up. And then you start to get rock slides and all that kind of stuff. So you have to be in a safe zone by about 12 o'clock in the afternoon. So, you know, you've got, as you're climbing up to the summit, you've got certain points you have to make or you have to turn around if somebody's going really too slow around that standpoint. And so that's what happened. It was wicked cold. It turns out I've got stage 2 frostbite on my right foot. I can't feel 3 toes on my right foot now. I'm supposed to be leaving for Denali on June the 6th, but I may have to push that climb off for another year because I can't go like this right now. So I would just tell you, it's a great sport. It's kind of a combination between an extreme endurance sport and extreme outdoor adventure. It's a lot of fun. You don't have to go up to those kind of high, you know, mountains. My son and I do a lot of climbing in the 14ers in Colorado. It's you know, you just do that and it's simply a day. But for those of you know, want to get into it, anyway, it's a really cool sport. It's kind of crazy, but it is a lot of fun to be around people around that.
So. How do you prepare your body for those altitudes?
So a great question. I do just a ton of cardio. I mean, I've done a lot of marathons over the years, and there's a lot of similarities around the cardio preparation. But the problem is, you never know if you're going to be experiencing high altitude, you know, sickness until you get up to it. You can have a lot of experiences around it, but until you actually get up to it, that's what happened. In fact, we started out with 13 climbers. 11 climbers, and two had to be medevaced off. One had high altitude pulmonary edema, and the other one, you know, blew his knee out. But you just never know. And you're spending all this money to do this, all this training, and you can get up there and get sick. And that's what happened to this guy.
So you don't take oxygen or anything with the...
No, you don't really need oxygen until you hit 25,000. So we were up to just under 23,000. You know, the guide's got supplemental oxygen. The thing about oxygen, though, is that once you get on oxygen, you can't get off of it. Which is, you know, if you knew about some of the climbers that died up on Everest, they were on supplemental oxygen, and you get off of it, and you're going to die. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. You only want to use it if you know you can get a helicopter evac, because you're only going to be on it for as long as that cylinder is going to last you. So.
And how long does that cylinder last?
I mean, it's probably, depending on size, you know, a few hours is probably all the, I mean, the guide comes with a couple of them, but, you know, it's...
So I can't imagine being those altitudes, because I've been, you know, 9, 10, 11,000, and thought I was going to lose my mind.
Yeah.
I couldn't handle
well, it. Well, and like I was talking about with Ian is, that's, what I've learned is when it comes to hiring lawyers, surgeons and mountaineering guides, it doesn't pay to go cheap. You want to pay for the best. You want to go with the best. And the thing about Ian has a lot of success rates because he does the acclimation piece. Because if you tried going from, you know, this elevation up to say 16,000 feet, you know, it's going to kick your butt. But what Ian does is he's got it down to a science where you're doing all these acclimation climbs first, and then, you know, you're kind of building your body up for it. So that's really the trick in it. There's a science behind it.
How long does it take to come acclimated?
It usually takes, you have to do 3 acclimation climbs in about a week. So, you know, it takes about a week, you know. They've got these hypoxy tents that you can use that people, you know, that's the latest thing now where they're using hypoxy tents. And then there's one person that was using a hypoxy tent, climbed Everest, and was able to come back, and they did that in something like 48 hours. And so, you know, it's just, so, you know, they're beating the science around that piece. So I don't have an epoxy tent, but that's another way to do it too. So.
One last comment about talk about the mental component, because of the 11, we've lost 2 already, 1 to a knee, 1 to but how many made it to the top?
There was only 3 of us that made it. Yeah. And what happened is, so I will just tell you that there's so many similarities of mountaineering and marathon running. It's probably, I would say it's probably 60% physical and 40% mental. What happened is the night before, we were at Camp 3, and the night before, Ian got everybody together and says, look, if there's no shame in quitting, if you don't want it, you know, if you don't think you can make it. So he started planting the seed in it. Now he owns the company, he's got exposure to this. 6 people had died on Aconcagua before we attempted to climb. So, the climbing season is only 3 months long. Okay. So, you know, typically about 1 person dies per month on that. And so, the brand reputation for Ian and it is really high. If somebody dies or he has a catastrophic illness. So he was saying, look, there's no problems with you guys want to quit. There's no problem with that. So we started planting the seeds, and then we got into the climb. We left around 2 o'clock in the morning. We got in about 3 hours in at this one point, and the Aconcagua guide, he had been guiding on the mountain for 20 years. He stopped everybody. So in the morning, I should say, we started with, we had 11. 2 people dropped out, even didn't even start the climb. They just decided that they weren't up for it. So then we're down to 9. And then we got up there, and 6 more people quit at that 3 hour mark, because the guide said, hey, this is the time. Look, if you're going to quit, if you're not feeling it, turn around. And 6 people turn around. I was like, where are you going? Like, what's going on? So, you know, these are people, probably one of those probably didn't make the right decision to turn, but the rest of them was just a mental thing. And I kind of, there's so many, like, things that are so much, you know, like life, you know, really. It's so much related to that kind of thing. It's so much of it is the mental piece, and about the preparation piece, the resilience, but also, you know, getting ready for the mental challenges and knowing. And that's the beauty of being aligned with our faith, is, you know you have Jesus. We know we have Jesus on our side to be able to help. You know, that's that deep well that we can tap into, not only just fellowship, but Jesus, to tap into, you know, as a guidepost for strength. And, it's been a savior for me, you know, over the last 10 years and all the different twists and turns. My mom dying, you know, 2 years ago. I came here back to Bloomington to care for her. And it's just, again, that well that you can kind of tap into, which has been so great. So,
yeah, Jim. I was curious, so you said 3 of you made it up there. What's kind of a minimum number for a safety standpoint? And also from you mentally relying on, well, at least there's another guy here I can count on or something.
Well, that's a great question. And it's that's the reason why Ruben, the guide, said, look, if you don't turn around now, if you don't think you can make it, it's going to be harder, because you have to have 1 guide per 2 climbers. Okay. It's generally, and in fact, some countries, like Ecuador, requires that by law. You have to have 1 guide per 2 climbers, and that's generally the ratio. So if you have all these people that drop out, what happens is, if they're dropping out at different times, the guide has to take those people down, and so you're left with fewer and fewer guides. So it turned out, because everybody quit at the time, that 1 guide took them down, and we had 1 guide per client. We had three guides along with Ian. So we had, I think, three or four guides, and there was only three clients. So I felt really, really good because it was really, really icy. And the thing about mountaineering is the 80% of the accidents or 90% of the accidents happen not on the way up, but on the way down. And the reason for that is because you're a lot more tired, your guard is let down. Plus, you know, when you fall, your face like this, you got your ice axe, you've got to pivot around and tag the mountain. And whereas if you're going up the mountain, you start to slide, you get your ice axe, it's really easy. It's a split second reaction. But it's this idea that especially if you trip over yourself going down the mountain, it's really, really hard. In fact, that happened to me on Mont Blanc. I caught a crampon on my boot. This is right after we had summited. We're going down this place, it's about 100 yards. It was probably about 2,000 feet drop on either way. The path was this about this wide. It was just going straight down. And I, like an idiot, I mean, I wasn't focused. You're supposed to walk, you know, with kind of your feet extended. I was really tired, and I pulled caught my left crampon on my right gaiter, and I went down. And I, you know, was able to catch myself with the ice axe, or I would have dragged me and the guy behind me and the guy down. I would have killed all of us, you know, and just because of just being tired. And so, that's what that's all about. So.